So it's my personal and professional pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Peter Gerjets. Peter is a full professor at the University of Tübingen in Germany, where he's been on the faculty since 2002. He's the head of the Hypermedia Lab and an executive member of the Knowledge Media Research Center, or KMRC. The Knowledge Media Research Center is one of the world's leading institutions for the investigation of multimedia learning. Peter received his PhD at the University of Göttingen. In 1999, he was honored with the Young Scientist Award of the German Cognitive Science Society. Peter serves or has served on a variety of editorial boards. I'll mention just a couple or a few. The Journal of Educational Psychology, Computers and Human Behavior, Educational Research Review, and the Educational Technology Research and Development Journal. I met Peter initially via email in 1998. He had proposed some ideas for research based on our mutual interests. And this began a collaboration that with Peter and his colleague Katarina Scheiter, who is already doing research with, and myself, that's continued to this day. In fact, I'm happy to report that there is a manuscript of ours languishing on their desks. I'm happy to report it because it had been languishing on my desk for about a year and a half, and the guilt they induced was almost unbearable. So I'm glad to have that at least temporarily over with. Not surprisingly, given Peter's prolific research, our collaboration really represents just a small fraction of his research efforts and his output. Peter's research interests include a variety of things, which I would say would fall broadly into the category of educational technology, but let me mention a few specific areas of interest. His research interests include learning and problem solving in hypermedia environments, knowledge acquisition from dynamic visualizations, and learning and instructional design, just to name a few. Peter has a long and distinguished publication record, and recently I saw a list of what he considers his top 10 publications. I was crushed to see that of our various publications together, only one of them made the list. Despite that blow to my ego, it's my pleasure to introduce today Peter Gerjets, whose talk is entitled Bridge Over Troubled Water, From Cognitive Science to Designing Digital Instruction. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Gerjets.
Choose. Thank you, Richard, for that unexpectedly kind introduction. And thanks to the organizers for inviting me to present our work on digital instruction to this audience. The first thing I want to do this morning is to show you some examples of the kind of digital instruction we are interested in. Most of our work focuses on multi-representational and example-based hypermedia environments and on multimedia materials like animations or digital videos and on ways to improve these materials so that learner readers can benefit from them. Usually we work into domains like math and science with this stuff. And what interests us is the question how digital instruction, this kind of digital instruction affects learning processes, why and when this kind of instruction is effective, and how to decide about important design features like designing the pictorial and verbal representations that go into these materials. So my topic today is how we can use concepts and methods from cognitive science to inform or to improve the design of these instructional materials. And on first sight, there are obviously a lot of insights in cognitive science and methods in cognitive science that should be useful, like insights on knowledge representation, knowledge construction, cognitive architectures and their limitations, and methods like task analysis and process measurement. And of course, there have been a couple of successful examples already of cognitive scientists going over this bridge from the rock of cognitive science to educational psychology, educational technology, and improving things there, for instance, the work on cognitive tutors based on the ACT-R theory. In our field of multimedia and hypermedia design, two other theories have been very prominent in recent years or in the recent decade, which are the cognitive load theory by John Sweller and the cognitive theory of multimedia learning by Richard Mayer. These researchers have come the other way around, come from educational psychology and try to get insights from cognitive science to improve their theories on design and digital materials. Both of these researchers have been among the top productive educational psychologists for the last 20 years, and they obviously have really shaped the field, and both of their theories are also remarkably similar, and they share the same approach on how to use cognitive science for informing digital instruction or instructional design. And so we'll take that as a background or as a starting point for our own reflections on how to use these concepts. Their approach can be described as a framework and principle approach. They start with some theoretical building blocks from cognitive science, put them together into a kind of boxes and arrows framework, and try to derive some general design principles for digital instruction from these frameworks. And this is how it looks with regard to the building blocks. Things classical cognitive science models go into it, like a multi-store model, modality-specific sensory memory, resource limitations in working memory model by Baddeley, dual coding theory and mental model theory and problem schemas as ways of knowledge representation. And then it's put together into a framework that looks like this. This is a representation of the cognitive theory of multimedia learning. There is a structure, a cognitive architecture focusing on working memory and on dual coding. So there's information, pictorial, verbal information, coming in as a sensory system, coming into working memory, and the focus is on the processes in working memory here, how they get integrated into a model, mental model, connected to long-term memory. And the second important thing with the model is that there are three broad classes of cognitive processes defined that are based on this mental model structure that is at the heart of the theory. And these broad processing classes are essential, extraneous, and generative processes that are closely tied to the role of these processes to mental model construction. So the idea is that there are essential processes that are necessary just to get the information into working memory. This is selecting words and pictures. And then there are generative processes that are important to construct an integrated mental model that is organizing words into a verbal model, organizing images into a pictorial model, and integrating both models into an overall model with prior knowledge. And then there's a third important category of processes named extraneous processes. These are other processes that may even inhibit or are not necessary, not important for mental model construction. So this is a broad impression of the type of theory. The cognitive load theory by John Sweller is remarkably similar, looks very similar, even a bit simpler. It just focuses on working memory and working memory limitation, and it introduces the idea that long-term memory information is stored as schemas, and that the bottleneck for schema construction is processes in working memory. And again, there are three broad classes of cognitive processes defined in working memory called intrinsic, extraneous, and germane processes, which are connected to three specific kinds of cognitive load. Intrinsic cognitive processes are processes necessary for schema construction, thus bringing the information that has to be integrated into a schema into working memory. The error is both-sided because it's easier to represent information if you already have schema, so you can represent complex things with simple elements. Then there's germane load. This is caused by processes that promote schema abstraction, for instance, comparisons, elaborations. And then again, there's a third category, extraneous cognitive load. These are other processes that is inhibit or that are not necessary, not useful for schema construction. So the series are similar, and they're both focusing on this three type of cognitive processes in working memory, and use this distinction to derive some general design principles for instructional materials. And the rationale of these principles is that the materials should be designed so that the extraneous processing is reduced, the essential or intrinsic processing is managed, and the generative or germane processing is stimulated. And this can be broken down into specific principles. Here are five of those principles that I will go through in my talk, but there are several other principles that are derived by this rationale. And this is only a first step to derive these design principles. The second step is to test empirically whether they work out, whether they really produce effects on learning. And I will just give one example for the modality principle, how that works. Modality principle says it's better to use spoken words, spoken verbal information, with pictorial information like animations or pictures, because you use both sensory channels at the same time. It's better for managing essential processing. And this is tested by designing simplified learning materials in the lab like this. This is a prototypical learning material used by Richard Mayer. A short lesson, 2 minutes lesson, with an animation explaining how weather, lightning is produced, and it's a system-paced presentation of this animation combined with 300 words of explanation. And to test the modality principle, you give a spoken version of that and a written version of that, and afterwards you compare whether learning is better for the spoken version than the written version. You can replicate that with similar materials, and if finally you see that the principle works, these principles are announced as useful instructional design principles. So here's a workflow in a nutshell, from theory to practice, or from cognitive science to educational technology in these models. You take some building blocks about mental representation, about cognitive architecture. You construct a framework. You derive a list of general design principles from this framework. You test these principles with simplified learning materials in the lab. You replicate this testing. And if it works out to be reliable, you distribute the principles as proven guidelines for designers. That's the subtitle of this book, for instance. This is an approach that has obviously some merits. It's theory-based, it's systematic, it's empirically, statistically tested, it's replicated, it's practically relevant. So it's a good thing. But it has a couple of serious problems from our perspective. Theoretical problems with the justification of the design principles. There are a couple of theoretical inconsistencies with the justification. Usually the justifications, the causal chains postulated are not empirically verified. It's very effect-oriented. You apply a principle, you see if it works, and if it works, it's fine. And then there are practical problems. The principles sometimes just do not apply. You try it, but it's not working out. Or the principles are sometimes just not specific enough to really inform the design of materials. And we think that the most important thing underlying these problems is that the underlying cognitive and motivational processes beyond these principles are not really specified and not really tested. So this is what I want to talk about in the rest of the talk, how we should specify this and go deeper beyond this very general framework. And from our own research, we learned three lessons, namely that it's important to do the specifications of three different levels. First, on the level of the frameworks themselves, how they argue, how they justify the principles. Second, on a level below, going lower down to more elementary processes. And third, on a level above, that takes representations more seriously in their context of application. And I have two examples for each of these lessons. First, specifications at the framework level. So here's the idea that within that framework, there's some reasoning, some rationale why a specific manipulation should lead to better learning. And there's a specific causal chain that need to be specified and need to be tested. That basically comes down to measuring the postulated processes and mediators and to directly testing the hypothesized relations. My first example here is about the voice principle, and it's based on the PhD project of Stefanie Lienek. The voice principle says that people learn more deeply when the words in a multimedia message are spoken by a friendly voice than by an unfriendly voice. The justification is social cues in a multimedia message induce learners to react socially. This is an idea borrowed from media equation theory. And so the idea, the causal chain behind this principle is that if you have a friendly voice in a multimedia message, the speaker will be evaluated as being friendly. A social response will be stimulated, namely interest to listen to the speaker. This will result in more effort to understand the speaker, a generative cognitive processing, and finally the learning outcomes will be better. So we have evidence for the effect. Friendly voices are better than unfriendly voices or machine-generated voices with regard to the learning outcomes, but we have no evidence with regard to the causal chain. So Steffi started to measure things like the speaker evaluation or like interest to listen and effort to understand to see whether it works out, that this is a causal chain that produces this effect. And she was interested in the effect of male versus female speakers in a hypermedia learning environment on probability theory. So she manipulated whether the narrated animation explaining some worked examples in that learning environment would be spoken by a female or by a male voice, with the idea that female voices are usually rated as more friendly. And in that comparison, what were the results? Well, she found indeed that a female speaker resulted in a more friendlier speaker rating. Learners report more interest to listen, they report more effort to understand, and their learning outcomes were better. So everything is fine. But when she started to test whether these mediators really correlated with the learning outcomes, she found absolutely no correlation. So the principle seems to apply, but there's no evidence for the suggested causal changes between these variables. So it may be that the principle apply, but for completely other reasons than postulated. So she started to think about what explains these findings and came up with an interesting idea. Namely, it may be that there's a schema incongruity occurring because there's a female speaker and a supposedly male domain, namely mass. She came up with the idea because it was a study of gender. She measured gender stereotypes of the learners, and she found that the effect of voice on learning outcomes was only there for learners, female and male learners, with a high availability of the masculine gender stereotype, whereas the effects of voice on speaker rating, interest, effort were there for all learners. So she followed up on that idea and did a second replication where there was a free choice of speaker with the idea to cue stereotypes by making people choose between female and male speakers. And there she replicated the effect, but for all learners. So this is it's not waterproof. It's for sure that these causal chains should be substantiated, but it is an indication that there may be a completely other causal story behind this principle than the one that is postulated in the framework by Richard Mayer. Second example for the same point, spatial contiguity principle. This is work by Gabriele Czerniak. The spatial contiguity principle claims that people learn better when corresponding words and pictures are presented near rather than far away from each other on the screen. The justification is a separated format leads to a visual search for corresponding information and results in increased cognitive load. So there's a causal chain leading from separated format to a visual search, which should show up in gazes between text and pictures looking for corresponding things. Then there should be extraneous load by the search processes, and the learning outcomes should worsen. We have several replications of that effect, that separated formats lead to worse learning, but we have no real evidence for that story. So Gabriele started to measure eye tracking, whether really there are these gaze switches between text and picture searching for corresponding information. And she measured different types of cognitive load to find out whether it's really extraneous cognitive load that is increased and that causes this effect. So she did a study with this material on the human kidney, how the kidney works. And she has a version which separated the text on the left side and the pictures on the right side. There are numbers assigning text portions to picture portions. And she has an integrated format where the text is fit into the picture. And then she has a dual task measure as an overall cognitive load measure in a version where sometimes the screen flashes red or green and the subject has to react as fast as possible to indicate that as a measure of overall cognitive load due to the learning task. What did she find? The separated format, as expected, leads to worse learning outcomes, so the effect is there. With regard to cognitive load measurement, she had the overall cognitive load with the dual task measure, and she asked three questions to tackle specific parts of the cognitive load. She asked for the difficulty of the learning materials as indicator for extraneous cognitive load, difficulty of the learning contents as indicator for the intrinsic cognitive load, and the level of concentration during learning as a positive, at least in the German language, positive indicator of effort as a germane cognitive load. So three subtypes of cognitive load and an overall measure. And she found that there was no effect on overall cognitive load. That might be because due to the separate format, the extraneous cognitive load went up and the germane cognitive load went down. And the mediation analysis revealed that both of these effects are important. They independently mediated the effect of the separated format on learning outcomes. So it's important that there's an extraneous increase in extraneous load and a decrease in germane load. So let's look how these cognitive load pattern is maybe caused by gaze switches or searching for information. She did eye tracking and looked specifically for gazes within the text and within the picture and between text and picture that indicated finding things that correspond to each other. And she found completely unexpected that the gazes between text and picture, the bad visual search processes, were reduced in the separated format, whereas the within text switches were increased. And then she found that both of these switches lead to extraneous cognitive load, but only the within text switches were correlated to learning outcomes. So the supposedly bad switches between text and picture are not the bad ones. The bad ones, if any, are the within text switches here. So there's no evidence for the initially suggested causal chain. The spatial contiguity principle applies, but obviously for other reasons than postulate. Probably it's difficult for learners to find corresponding parts in the picture and they just remain in the text, but they experience that as a difficult material and their concentration goes down. But it has nothing to do with search processes between text and pictures. So the bottom line of these two examples, principles may apply, but for other reasons than postulated. And to check for that, it's important to measure the postulated mediators to better understand the cognitive processes behind the principles. Well, this is one level, checking the reasoning within the framework, whether it's correct. The second level is specifications at a lower foundational level. Here the idea is that if theoretical and empirical inconsistencies occur that are not resolvable at the framework level, like the ones that I just mentioned, it might be necessary to go down or go back to deeper structures and processes, to the building blocks that go into this framework. And I have two examples for that. The first one is on signaling principle. It's based on the PhD project of Halschka-Jarotschka. The signaling principle claims that people learn better when cues are added that direct the learner's attention towards the essential materials. So the justification is it reduces extraneous processing by helping to select, organize, and integrate relevant information in working memory. But there are some empirical and theoretical inconsistencies. There's mixed evidence for the effectiveness of signaling. It could be shown for verbal materials, but the effect is not reliable for visual cues. So sometimes it works, sometimes it's not working. And probably the problem is that we should take perceptual and attentional processes more seriously here when we decide what to cue, how to cue, and when to cue. And Halschka tried to take perceptual processes more seriously on several dimensions. She wanted to develop an eye movement modeling to convey experts' perceptual strategies to novices, and she did that with video materials, medical education, like the one on the right here. It's about epileptic seizures in infants and diagnosing different types of these seizures. And what she did is first a task analysis. Is this material really filled with perceptual challenges? So are there things like salient things that are not relevant, or relevant things that are not salient, relevant things that are transient and go fast away, a high level of realism with distracting information that is not important, and so on. And she found that this material had these properties. Second step is compare experts and novices with regard to their eye movements, their perceptual processing. Are there indicators that novices have difficulties with the perceptual challenges, and are there indicators that experts have strategies to cope with these challenges that may be interesting to teach to students? If this is the case, she does an expert modeling. She records the eye movements and the utterances of an expert while the expert explains a video case like this. And then she does a gaze replay by superimposing experts' gazes and utterances onto an instructional video to provide guidance for learners, perceptual or attentional guidance with two versions of that material. So the picture below shows how it works. The expert looks at a complex visual stimuli, explains something that has to be learned from it. The gazes of the expert are recorded, and the novice sees the gazes of the expert and hears what the expert explains. So this is how the material looked like.
masser af trækninger i de højre side ekstremiteter. Om vi skal kalde det et klonisk anfald, eller myoklonier, kan vi diskutere, men det er nok nærmest et klonisk anfald, han har.
Samtidig. And this is a same video superimposed with a little circle indicating where the expert looks at the time when he explains what he says.
Ja, her ser vi en tilsyneladende sovende dreng, som har masser af trækninger i de højre side ekstremiteter.
I think that this is an attentional guiding, so you have the same perceptual stimulus as before, but superimpose something that shows you where you should put your attention to. The third thing is more like perceptual guidance because it reduces the perceptual input. The video is a little bit blurred and only the parts where the expert is focusing on is sharp. Looks like this.
Ja, her ser vi en tilsyneladende sovende dreng, som har masser af trækninger i de højre side ekstremiteter. Om vi skal kalde det et klonisk anfald eller.
Maybe it's difficult to see because the display is anyway a little bit unsharp. So the task of the learners was they got four learning videos and then they had to categorize test videos with novel children and try to describe them accurately and try to diagnose which type of epileptic seizure it is. The results show that the spotlight display was very effective in guiding the learner to follow the expert's gazes. The yellow bars show the pixel distance from the gazes of the learner to the gazes of the expert during learning. And it was also very effective for the test tasks, the correctness of description and the diagnosis of the epileptic seizures were improved in the spotlight version. The circle version did not improve that. And even more, in the test videos, we could also show that the perceptual processes were improved. The learners with the spotlight video looked faster at the relevant areas in the test videos and remained longer on the relevant areas in the test videos. So it seems that using expert gazes as a guide to cue seems useful to provide guidance for learners. The perceptual guidance seems to be more superior to the attentional guidance, so the principle in this case might apply, but only under very specific circumstances. So for instance, with regard to how to display the gazes. If we try to understand that in terms of the cognitive theory of multimedia learning, probably we would say that the spotlight display does something between the learning materials and the sensory memory. The perceptual input is already reduced to the important things, whereas the circle display, the attentional guidance, helps to select information from sensory memory to the working memory. So there might be a distinction between role of attention and perception, and there also might be a role of executive processes, because in the attention the circle display, you still have distracting details like this little rabbit or what it is on the children's claws that you might be tempted to look at. So there's finer grained research necessary to understand why this works in this case and not in this case, and this is a message that I want to make with this point. A second example is about the modality principle. That's work from Anne Schüler. The modality principle claims that people learn more deeply from pictures or animation in combination with spoken words than with written words. The justification is pictures in combination with written words may cause an overload in visual working memory. Again, there are some empirical and theoretical inconsistencies. There is, to our perspective, a mixed evidence for the effectiveness of spoken words. The modality effect could be shown to be reliable only for quite standard materials. And standard materials is what I've shown you before with the lightning development. Short materials, simultaneous presentation of text and pictures, system paced, maybe some time pressure under it. We tried, or Anne tried, in 8 studies to replicate this effect with a bit more complex materials or materials with more learner pacing, and never found a modality effect for these materials. So we thought this might be something wrong. It might apply only under very specific conditions. And we also found that there are some theoretical inconsistencies with regard to Bailey's working memory model. I will not go very much into detail with regard to that, but Anna herself has a talk this afternoon at 1 p.m. and she probably can explain better what is wrong with this thing. The basic idea is that Meyer claims if we have words and pictures In the visual channel, we have an overload in the visual working memory. If we have spoken words, there's no problem because spoken words use the other channel. The problem is that processing of written words in Badley's working memory's model is different. And in Badley's model, the written words from the sensory memory directly go into the phonological working memory component, so there is no overload in the visual working memory in Badley's model. The only place where there is or there might be an overload is in the sensory memory in case that written words and pictures are presented simultaneously under time pressure or system pace so that you cannot look at both of them at the same time. And this is exactly what the standard material does. So our claim would be that the conditions under which the modality effect occurs have more to do with resource conflicts in sensory memory than resource conflicts in working memory. So the bottom line of these two principles, two studies, is the principles may apply, but only under very specific conditions, and we have to clear up these conditions. They might have to do, for instance, with the role of perceptual processes or sensory memory. So with regard to methodology, it's important to find tighter theoretical and methodological connections to models of perception, attention, and work memory. And with regard to experimentation, that will also imply that we need more basic paradigms with controlled materials and more subtle measures that are related to different cognitive substructures to really clear up these inconsistencies. So this is a way down from the framework level, going closer to basic cognitive psychology research. Another problem or another way is a way up, going closer to realistic, authentic, instructional materials and domains. So this is the third lesson about specifications of representations in context. Here the idea is that we not only have to clear up things at the framework level, at the level beyond that, below that, but also specify more precisely the supporting roles of external representations in specific contexts. For instance, take the multimedia principle. It claims that people learn more deeply from words and pictures or animations than from words alone. And the justification is that learners can construct a verbal and a pictorial mental model and build connections between these two models. The problem is this principle is by far not specific enough to guide the design of realistic materials for authentic instructional contexts. What would be needed here is a task analysis that shows which mental representations do learners need to construct by means of which mental processes in order to understand a specific domain content and to achieve a specific learning outcome. So in the second step, which external representations might be able to support this process? Well, it's much more specific than just an overall multimedia principle. The picture represents how this should work. We should start from a specific content domain, say probability, and think about the contents, about the learning objectives, and try to find out what kind of knowledge representation do we need to accomplish this type of task. And then we should go to back to the universe of possible pictorial representations and find out which of those possible representations should we feed into the system to support the construction of this type of mental representation that we want. If we do not do this type of process, but just put in some multimedia material that just comes to our mind, we might easily end up with a situation like this. This represents 76 studies or comparisons between static and dynamic visual materials from the meta-evaluation of Höfler and Leutner. And it turns out that 21 of these studies showed that dynamic materials were better, two showed that static materials were better, and the rest, 53, showed no difference. So this is a little bit random level. So if you just throw some animation in and hope that it will help learning, you might easily end up with it not helping. So it's important to increase the number of green dots here in this graphic. And I will show two examples of how we try to do that for specific domain contents. The first example is about multimedia principle in MAS, or animation in MAS. And here we try to support learning from worked-out examples with animations. We started with a task analysis based on a standard problem-solving model of how learners, how word problems should be solved. There's a word problem in MAS. The learner should construct a situation model of the situation that is described in that word problem. You should extract the structural problem features and put them into a problem model, more abstract problem model. You should translate the problem model into solution procedure, and finally, you should abstract a schema from this solution procedure to be able to transfer the procedure to other problems. So we just straightforward started to construct an animation that should help to construct the situation model. So we call that iconic animation. We just depicted the situation described in the word problem. If it's about guessing a PIN code in probability, we depicted somebody entering a PIN code. And then we animated how the situation changes from step to step, guessing the first number, the second number, the third number, and so on. And thought it might help learners to construct a situation model. What happens is we had a static version of that, just showing pictures after each step, how the situation is now, with a dynamic version. The static version worked quite okay. It improved solving isomorphic problems and reduced learning time, but the dynamism had absolutely no beneficial effect. It was even distracting, obviously. The learning was worse than with text alone. So we went back and thought again, what could dynamism be good for in this type of task? And then we thought, an important challenge here is the translation between the different mental representations that we want, translating the situation model into the problem model into the solution procedure. And we tried to come up with an animation that supports this translation process, which is a dynamic process. And this is what we call hybrid animation. Hybrid because it starts iconic, represents the realistic situation, and then transforms into a more symbolic representation, which can be used to explain the solution procedure. And this turned out to be very effective. It produced better learning outcomes for isomorphs and for near transfer items and for far transfer items. And this is how it looks like. It's about an algebra word problem about a forest area with two types of trees, spruces and pines, and one fourth of spruces and one tenth of the pines are damaged. And the question is how many of these coniferous trees are damaged overall. So we start with the concrete trees, spruces and pines, as a representation, and then transform them into little squares that go into a big square that represents a forest. Then finally, we have the two sets of trees, the 400 pines and the 1,700 spruces. And then we try to visualize the proportions, the tenths and the fourths of the spruces and the pines. And then we connect the mathematical expression to it, that it's one fourth of this and one tenth of this, and that you have to add these two quantities to have a representation of the overall proportion of damaged trees. And we end up with an abstract representation that is the same for all of the different cover stories, so that learners are able to abstract schemas from that type of work. A second example is from biology. It was a project about fish locomotion together with marine biologists and media designers, and it's work based on PhD projects by Birgit Imhoff, Tim Kuhl, and Vanessa Pfeiffer. And here we started with the idea that we could have one domain like locomotion pattern of fishes and different type of learning objectives. For instance, just recognizing the locomotion pattern. They are different. You have to recognize in a video what type of locomotion pattern is that. This is mainly about constructing a dynamic mental model supporting this type of construction. A different thing is understanding the physics of fish locomotion. How do fishes propel? How does that generate thrust underwater? This turned out to be mainly about relating dynamic features. Velocities, acceleration, forces that change over time. A third task is using fish locomotion to classify species when diving. So species classification is a static thing usually. You count things like fins and so on, static things. But we thought if you do it in a realistic setting while diving, it might be helpful to connect these static features to dynamic features that you actually perceive when you dive. And what we did is, we did studies on all three of these objectives where we compared static and dynamic materials and tuned the dynamic materials so that they improved the learning outcomes with regard to these learning objectives. The first task was the easiest, so helping learners to understand different types of fish locomotion pattern means helping them to construct a dynamic mental model, and we just made good, nice animations that clearly showed the differences between this locomotion pattern and that made it unnecessary for learners compared to a static version to mentally animate the locomotion patterns themselves. And it turned out that this is a better learning material than a static material. It was more difficult to construct dynamic material that is helpful to understand the physics of fish locomotion. I will show an example that we finally arrived with that is very effective.
Magnitude of the reaction force. The reaction force of water acts at a right angle on the propelling element. The length of the arrow corresponds to the strength of the reaction force, and the direction of the arrow corresponds to the direction of the reaction force. The reaction force depends on the velocity of the corresponding fish's body section. The higher the instantaneous velocity of the body section, the higher the force acting upon the water, and hence the higher the reaction force. On the one hand, as we've previously illustrated, as the velocity of a body section varies with its position, the magnitude of the reaction force also varies. On the other hand, the velocity of a propelling element also varies with the changing frequency of the undulatory movement, in turn changing the magnitude of the reaction force.
So our main rationale here was to support learners by allowing them to draw perceptual inferences. So making things clearly visible that they otherwise, or from static visualizations, have to infer. For instance, the velocities of different points, acceleration between points, relations between accelerations and the force vector, relations between frequencies and the force vector. And we even exaggerated a bit to make it really perceptible that there are changes in velocities and changes in the sizes of the force vectors. And this turned out to be a good idea to help learners to understand these physical principles of fish locomotion. Third task, species classification during diving. As I said, this species classification is mainly an issue of static features. So we constructed underwater videos in a bay in Spain with the fish types that were there, 18 species, and we constructed digital videos with stills from it, where we use the stills to explain the static features that are important to classify the fish species. And then we compared two versions, the digital video with the stills with important information and some moving of the fish between the stills to have the extra dynamic information with a still-only version. So only showing the stills with audio commentaries explaining the important features. With the idea that just for learning the important features for classification, the stills might be better because they do not distract with these movements, they just focus on the important things. But if you have to apply this classification in a realistic environment where you see the fish moving, connecting the dynamic information with this important static information might be superior. Our design was like this. We had learners in the classroom with these digital videos learning from DVD players, 90 minutes, to classify these 18 fish species. It was in Spain, in this bay where we made these videos. Then we had a post-test with new fishes. They had to classify the species. And then we allowed them to go for snorkeling for 4 hours using the DVD players at the beach. So they had another learning session where they combined the learning with the video with the realistic encounter. And we hypothesized that in this case, the dynamic version might outperform the static version. And that's what's actually happened. We found an interaction with the stills being superior in the first post-test and the digital video being superior in the second post-test. So the bottom line here is that these are very different types of dynamic visualizations. They can be helpful for understanding mass and science, but they should be designed based on a careful task analysis. Simple design guidelines are underspecified. It's more needed than just saying allow learners to construct a pictorial mental model. We have to exploit specific supporting functions of dynamic visualizations, which can be very different depending on contents and objectives. And we learned that domain experts play an important role here in analyzing the contents and the learning objectives and in developing suitable representations. I have a final remark on integrating levels of explanations, which is partially based on the structured view of theories in the philosophy of science. The remark has two parts. The first part is social. I think I showed that there are three important areas where research should be done. We should go deeper into the framework, we should go lower into the foundations, and we should go deeper into the context of representations. But probably different people will do this type of work. I assume that working on the framework will be done from educational psychologists, instructional designers. The connections to the low-level stuff will be done by memory researchers, perception researchers, eye-tracking researchers. The context-level stuff will be done by science educators, domain experts, computer scientists, maybe media designers, even people from semiotics reasoning about representations. So one problem is how can these people interact with each other or speak with each other? And there is one thing where I see an interesting role for the framework approach, that we can use a framework like the Mayer model or the cognitive load theory as a starting point, as a language for different people to talk to each other and fill their intuitions and their knowledge into a slot. So this, I think, is a good thing, a good role for a framework approach. A second good role for a framework approach could be something that I borrowed from the structuralist view of theories. I think it's clear that there will be no comprehensive unitary theory of multimedia learning that includes all the stuff that I talked about. It's different theoretical connections. And the structuralist view is that theories consist out of different theory elements. There are some basic theory elements that describe basic assumptions, fundamental assumptions that should apply in all instructional situations or all intent situations. And then there are additional theoretical and methodological assumptions that are specific to some intended applications. And deriving testable empirical hypotheses can only be done by combining these basic ideas with more specific theoretical and methodological assumptions. And it could be an idea to use frameworks like cognitive load theory or cognitive theory of multimedia learning as basic theory elements in this sense, and fill in the additional theoretical and methodological stuff that I talked about in these belts of additional theoretical and methodological assumptions. This could be a way to keep things together that would otherwise would be done by completely different people and would have not have close connection. Whether that works out and whether it will be possible to have a structuralist theory net like this that remains consistent is something that has to be shown in the future. Thanks a lot. Yes. Ken.
Great talk. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I like the social structure challenge and the way you laid that out. I wonder if if you would agree that the frameworks at this point could be improved, that there's an opportunity to get more of the representation content, the kind of benefit of the task analysis that you emphasized, characterized at the framework level, for instance, in terms of differences in kinds of knowledge representations and how they interact with these purportedly domain general principles. In other words, the conditions of applicability at some level seem like they have these representational connections, and that seems like our frameworks, these frameworks don't quite capture that interaction somehow.
Well,
as they stand.
I think the reasoning about the representations is quite specific to specific content domain specific. In the time when we were working on the fish project, on the fish materials, we were not sure whether we were not really doing didactics of biology or something like that. So something that is very much tied to the specific domain. Up to now, I do not really see a theory at that level. I see aspects, and it probably what is necessary is to find some generic features of domain, some generic challenges, for instance, that learning materials have, and some connections with specific features of multimedia materials that help to overcome these specific challenges. But to my knowledge, we do not have this yet. People start to systematize functions of representations like the Sharon Ainsworth framework, functions of representations, and people start to systematize features of content domains or learning objectives. But this is work to be done. I'm not sure whether it will be something like a principle later on. Probably with the, at the principle level, it should say it's helpful to use animations if one of the good effects of animation or the supporting functions of animations is there in the specific application. And then there should be an additional theory element like this saying what can be supportive functions of animations, let's say, for different types of learning contents. But actually, I don't know. I mean, there is no principle like that. We could try to fill it in like a principle, but I think there's not enough knowledge yet to do that.
I completely buy what you're talking about with the limitations to the framework approaches like cognitive load theory. And going back to your second to last slide and maybe building on what Ken was saying before, it seems like there's another alternative to these frameworks which would also involve collaborations between psychologists and education researchers and computer scientists, which is to actually try to build working models of how you think your learners are behaving. And that would provide not these principles, which may be too general or very nuanced or depending upon the materials, but it would actually give you a working system to try testing with your things, like the CMU's Sim Student project comes to mind.
So, I mean, the behaving of the learner is another very difficult topic. I didn't touch that at all, although we have done a lot of work on hypermedia learning, which is about learner control and strategies. To make it short, I would think everything breaks down when learner control comes in. So we couldn't replicate any principles when we did it in self-controlled hypermedia environments. And because the learner behavior is so important, and what the learner chooses to look at, and what the learner chooses to use as combinations of representations and so on, and why he does that, and there are some learners that do so, some learners do so, and there are clusters of learners that behave differently, different behaviors that are good for different learners. And at that point, this general approach becomes very difficult, I think. And I mean, you made a good point. These principles are derived in situations that are very fixed. Short interventions, short materials, and very system controlled materials. So they try to make all learners behave more or less the same and try to abstract over that. So when learner control comes in, we need probably something different. Yeah.
I like the three levels of explanation approach, but there's a fourth level that I think is fundamentally important if we're ever going to make this actually happen in the real world. And that is when you acknowledge that the vast majority of educational materials are probably being produced in PowerPoint or Flash or things like that that are done by mainstream software vendors. Unless we can get some of this embodied in those platforms, no one will ever really use it. I mean, can you imagine building some of this into those kinds of horizontal software technology that people actually use for developing educational materials?
I didn't get the point.
What I'm saying is that
what people actually use when they develop educational materials is things like PowerPoint and Flash and very horizontal software tools from mainstream vendors. So unless we can get this kind of more sophisticated framework in those tools, no one will ever use it. Okay. And that really is a fundamental problem for us here in this field. Yeah.
You mean, your point is, how sustainable is such kind of research showing that it's very good to have this and this and this type of material if you can't produce it with the software tools?
Yeah. Can you get it into PowerPoint? Can you imagine how this would end up in PowerPoint?
I mean, we produced some of the materials with Flash. That's not a problem. And you can even use some of the ideas that we had for PowerPoint, for instance, these hybrid animations that translate different representations into each other. But you are right, especially in the materials with the fish locomotion stuff, we used very advanced software stuff.
No, but I don't mean
modeling.
You doing it. I mean an ordinary
What I'm saying is we used very sophisticated software tools, and no teacher would use that to create some 3D animations for that. Yeah.
I can't resist following up on Rob's comment. When we've actually used Mayer's model in a model of learning by reading, where we take a chapter from a book on mechanics, translate the text just into simplified English, a natural language system understands the text, our sketch understanding system understands the diagrams. Actually, to integrate the two, we actually use the structure mapping engine because we treat it as an analogy problem, and that works very nicely. In fact, so nicely that the system can answer correctly 13 out of the 15 questions at the back of the chapter. Mm-hmm. So that shows you could make a simulation of someone learning from these materials, and then you tweak parameters of the simulation to model different kinds of learners. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a promising approach now that cognitive simulations, at least symbolic ones, can scale up to that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
Like other people, agree with you that these frameworks that you describe are producing information that's too general. But I think that a lot of your description has been very focused on educational psychology. And within that area, I think one of the problems with this these frameworks is that they're focusing on what I consider multimedia output to the student, and not focusing so much on the student's ability to use either digital or non-digital tools in a flexible and appropriate manner to interact with those materials. So if we want to have learning that's active, not passive, we really do need to be looking, first of all, looking more broadly across the multisensory perception and multimedia output literatures. We need to be looking, and there is literature within human interface design, cognitive science, and other areas that has been using things like cognitive load theory as a framework, general framework, to start building more empirical results, to start more eclectically combining that framework with other more powerful theories to explain the new empirical results being generated, and to design new technologies. So we're not interested in just using the existing technologies. They're clearly not optimal. They're not interactive enough, and they don't give students the power to manipulate flexibly the materials they need to. So I think this work is in progress, and some of your general comments were very accurate. But I think there is work going on. It's just that it's much more multidisciplinary than educational psychology.
Your point is another point, additionally to the learner control point that Rob Goldstone made that I had in mind to talk about, it's the instructional approach idea. So another variable is you don't just throw multimedia materials on the table, you embed it in the instructional approach. And the approach used here is just expository learning. So you just expose subjects to the materials and they should learn. But other things are, of course, possible. Explore them, like hypermedia learning, or use it for modeling, or construct things, or use it for simulations for a more constructivist approach. And we actually had a 6-year project together with colleagues from the Netherlands where we did that with this mass animation, mathematical word problem stuff, that we used exactly the same materials, same word problems, same tests, same kind of examples, and combines them with 4 different types of instructional approaches, like hypermedia learning or observational learning, modeling or inquiry learning, try to find out whether these representations have different affordances when they are embedded in different approaches. And this is indeed the case. So you need different representations for different approaches. The representations have a value in one approach, but not a value in a different approach. The overall question that you posed, whether we should have a more constructivist using of representations in learning by design or things like that, is a bit of a small fight, I think, between different people. So I think Mayer and Sweller both think of themselves that they are constructivists because people construct mental representations. But people, for instance, from inquiry learning think that these models do not really get the point that learners should construct for themselves, let's say, simulations in situations where they see certain things. It's a bit of an empirical war because Well, in our project, we could show that the observational of the inquiry learning stuff worked not that well as it should. The best thing was self-explanation, combining multimedia materials with self-explanation, stimulate, prompt, something like that. And the most effective thing actually was hypermedia learning. So just getting out things that you need and you're done. The observational learning had, or the inquiry learning, had some specific advantages. For instance, producing more intuitive knowledge, that you have an intuition about how probabilities change when you change some parameters. But that's because you use this type of simulation where you change parameters and get an intuition how what changes if you change that parameters. So I think it's a good point to say we should also study the design of multimedia materials as a learning approach. But I think different instructional approaches are all useful to study in combination with multimedia materials.
But the materials need to be interactive, and I really liked your theme of saying that one of the things that's critical is for there to be an easy translation between representational systems. In some of the work that we're doing, we're focusing more, again, not on multimedia output, but on the student's active multimodal input. But what we're finding is really critical is not only that the tools that are designed have the power to help students express representations of all kinds, linguistic and non-linguistic, but be able to, in a very facile way, move quickly between representations, so be able to generate and translate between representations as they think. And so I do think that's really critical, but again, I think that having a focus, too, on students' ability to adapt the type of representational system that they're constructing to represent as they need to within that domain and the phase of problem solving that they're engaged in at the moment, to give them the expressive power to do that really is critical. So I like that theme in your talk.
I want to make one last point on Peter's behalf, but I think we really need to stop because you've got about 3 minutes left if you want any coffee. I just want to say that one point that Peter made that I think may be getting lost in the shuffle is this idea of doing a task analysis. You can create very good Blackboard teaching materials, or very poor Blackboard teaching materials, very good multimedia learning materials, very poor multimedia learning materials, very good inquiry learning materials, and very bad inquiry learning materials. But if you don't do this task analysis first that Peter's mentioned, you're often going to be relying on experts' intuitions, and as we know, that's a bad, bad thing to do. As a room full of experts, I'd like to give a round of applause to Peter for this wonderful talk.